the whole book is written against that assumption. The Life and Death of Democracy, the title is apposite because I like to see in this book democracy as a fragile invention. It can be easily killed off. It can easily be put to death. The book is also an appeal to enfranchise a constituency that doesn't have the vote. This might sound extreme, but it's the dead. And I have the idea in my work that democracy among the living requires democracy among the dead. So this book is an attempt to put eyes, a pair of eyes, in the back of heads, or the head of readers, to show them characters, events, institutions that were born, usually in extraordinary circumstances, and have added up to what we understand as democracy today. There is no evolutionary pattern. There's no God-given, contrary to what was said, for example, in the Bush administration, there is no God-given entitlement to democracy, no God-given guarantees, no laws of progress in favor of democracy. A fragile, contingent invention, precious, and therefore its history is of great importance to the living and also to the future, the not yet born.
You don't believe in it as an evolutionary progression, but doesn't it have some evolutionary advantages? Isn't a competition, a free market of ideas and opinions, if you like, more likely to produce good ideas and opinions?
Well, this raises the whole question of what's so good about democracy. And in the book, I try to shoot a few goats of prejudice. Surprisingly, people will find that the history of justifications of democracy are today dead or completely unconvincing. For instance, the Athenians valued democracy in the Paniques, in the debating assembly, typically because it made Athens strong as an imperial power. Today we recoil at that idea that democracy is a good thing because it makes a state powerful and violent and good at war. We have a history of Christian justifications of democracy. They flourished in the 19th century, for example, in the anti-slavery movement. And you don't have to look very deeply into these Christian justifications of democracy to see that actually they're typically Protestant justifications of democracy. And that's very bad news, not only for Catholics and other Christian sects, but also for Muslims and Hindus and so on. So the question in the 21st century for me is, can we think in fresh ways? Can we speak differently? Can we find new good reasons for thinking that democracy is, as Churchill said in a famous contribution to the House of Commons in 1947, the least worst form of government? And in the book, there is a defense of the idea that democracy is the best weapon that we human beings have ever invented for humbling power.
Because
for preventing folly, hubris, for preventing foolish adventures. And I think that justification of democracy, that it helps us to keep our feet on the ground, that it brings a certain clarity and openness in making judgments about complex problems, that is of increasing importance given the scale of organization and power, global power, that today we're living in.
You wrote another book about Václav Havel, who was a dissident under the communist regime and imprisoned for many years and then became the president of Democratic Czech Republic. Is, in your historical examination, is democracy always better than no democracy at all?
The historical record on balance is yes.
Because?
Because it enables, as they say in India, people to kick the buggers out. That's what, if you talk to Indian journalists and scholars and people on the streets, that's the gut sense that people have. That it's all very well to talk benevolent dictators and autocrats. It's all very well to talk about bicycling monarchs. Or men of God ruling. but I'm afraid, or experts, but I'm afraid that the historical record shows that particularly as we move into modern times, that the belief that concentrated power always turns out well has a very tattered record. And not surprisingly, the spirit of democracy has regenerated. And I try to say in the book that since 45, the institutional thrust of democracy has changed because the first half of the 20th century, concentrated especially in Europe, was so disastrous.
But there is a weakness in democracy, isn't there?
There are many.
But in particular, you see it when there are revolutions. In the French Revolution, the Russian Revolution, most recently in the Iranian Revolution, when the Democrats up against the hard men, the totalitarians, the Democrats always lose.
Not always. And one of the miracles in the history of democracy, about which I write at some length in this book, are those moments where it doesn't turn out as you say. It doesn't result in victories for the hard men of power, those who are prepared to use violence and terror. The long-term effects of the English Revolution against monarchy is a case in point. It's true
in the short term,
Cromwell
became a dictator, effectively.
Yes, the thunk of the hair of a head of a monarch on an execution platform led, of course, to great violence and concentration of power under Cromwell. It led to great violence heaped against the Irish. It had global effects, and it led to the restoration of monarchy. But monarchy was never, ever again the same in Britain. It was humbled. It was taught the lesson, the hard lesson of power sharing. So revolutionary situations, it's true, are very dangerous for democracy, for the cause of democracy. They often don't turn out well. But when, as an historian, you look back on these periods, you see that things changed. And there are some revolutions, like the American, which were constitutionalist revolutions with a minimum of violence that produced, in the case of the United States, the most remarkable experiment of the 19th century.
Now, I know that you think that there are some good things about Australian democracy compared to, say, British democracy, because you now live in Britain. What are they?
The Westminster system, which used to be referred to affectionately here in Australia into the 80s, is dying in Britain, and there are quite a few morbid symptoms, including the gravest parliamentary corruption scandal going on in British politics at the moment since the early 19th century. It so happened, serendipity, that The Life and Death of Democracy was published in the midst of this gravest parliamentary corruption scandal. And that scandal happened because of the absence, may I say, of Australian-style integrity and accountability mechanisms, the kind that are the subject of the Queensland government's recent paper, just published during the last week, I believe. So Australia has a pretty remarkable history of giving gifts to democracy. In the 19th century, women won the right to vote and the right to stand for the first time in the world in South Australia. We are a country that more or less voted itself into existence. The secret ballot, known widely in the 19th century as the Australian ballot, was invented here. The first experiment happened in proportional representation in the world. The first Labour government in the world was elected, and so on.
You don't think there's anything of distance lending enchantment to the view here? Australians have deep cynicism about their politicians, and many of them will tell you that at least some of them must be corrupt.
Yes, it's a universal problem in all actually existing democracies. The decline of membership of parties in Britain 50 years ago, it was 1 in 11 adult Britons were a member of a party. Today, it's 1 in 88. the disaffection with parliaments, the spitting that happens when the word politician or politics is mentioned. Yes, this is quite clear. But as I see it, in the 21st century, Australian democracy has a great resilience, but there's a lot of unfinished business. Reconciliation with First Australians is only at the beginning. The question of a republic will not go away. The need for a Bill of Rights, I think, is transparent. I think that there are parliamentary reforms, not only in the states but at the federal level, that need to be carried out. There is no legislation in favour of whistleblowing, for example, in Canberra. And there is no equivalent of the Queensland Crime and Misconduct Commission. And above all, I think the foreign policy framework within which this relatively young Australian democracy can flourish is a mess. I think the crisis that has developed is a consequence of the bilateralism, the strong pro-US links. The question of where Australia fits in the Asia and Pacific region is one of the great political questions, I think, of the coming period.
You mentioned transparency, whistleblowing, the Queensland CJC. This brings us to what you call monetary democracy. What is that?
Don't mistake the word for monetary. Monetary democracy. Well, the idea, in a few words, is that the kind of democracy that developed after 1945, when there were only 12 democracies left on the face of the earth, the kind of democracy that developed is not to be described as liberal democracy or a continuation of what went on before. Representative democracy was typically called. What's new is that elections continue to be important. Democracy means nothing less than fair, free, clean elections. But democracy is coming to mean, and we are only at the beginning of this process, much more than that. It means the development, the nurturing of power scrutinizing, power monitoring bodies that are extra parliamentary. India is a cutting edge example of this.
How?
There was an attempt under Nehru to implant the Westminster model with great success. But India has invented a whole series of institutions and processes that greatly complicate that model of the Westminster system. So institutions like the panchayat system, local government, the compulsory representation of women, legislation before the Indian Parliament at the moment, lok adalats, these local courts, railway courts in Mumbai, fiercely contested student elections. So the political geography of democracy, as I see it, is changing towards a kind of rough and tumble democracy where there is a permanent scrutinizing of not only governmental but non-governmental power. And monetary democracy is different because for the first time in the history of democracy, these monitoring mechanisms are stretching across borders. Best case in point is the European Parliament and the attempt to develop a process of scrutinizing power across borders within the European Union. This is all new. Interestingly, we lack a good name for this new form, new historical form of democracy. And for a while, I toyed with various terms, complex democracy, post-representative, and came across this term. It's a bit ugly, but remember that the second phase of, so first phase of democracy, assembly democracy of the kind that the Greeks practiced. Remarkably, in the 18th century, this new phrase, representative democracy, was invented. And for the Greeks, it was something, it would have been an oxymoron. I believe that there is a transformation going on in the real world of democracy today. It began in 1945, which needs a new name. And this is the name that I have dubbed it with, monetary democracy. This permanent keeping of governments on their toes through not only elections, but also extra-parliamentary scrutiny.
And you mentioned far fewer people are interested in party politics anymore.
Yes, for this reason.
But partly it must also be because there's just less time and people have less time to devote to it. And what you're describing is a very diffuse system. Will people still be able to be in touch with this monetary democracy?
If you look at the UK, membership of Amnesty International is much higher than any political party. My kids would never be seen at a political party meeting. I don't think it's time per se. It's true that you could do, you know, a version of the Oscar Wilde. The problem with democracy is that it takes too many evenings. But I think that the sense is developing in many democracies that actually the level of integrity, the sense of trust is much higher with extra-parliamentary scrutiny bodies. Human Rights Watch, human rights organizations. I mean, you can name your favorite ones, but it's these organizations whose job is to blow the whistle on stupid government policies, or to embarrass politicians, or to try to point out realities that governments are not listening to. I think it's these institutions that have a much higher level of public trust. And that's symptomatic of this historical change that's going on. And I do not think that democracy can be reduced to, as in Afghanistan or Iraq, to simply the definition of elections. It's not enough. And it doesn't understand the attempts to do that, don't understand this historical shift that's taking place in the world of democracy.
After 1989, after the fall of the Soviet Union, there was, in some intellectual circles, almost a sense of complacency that not only was it the fall of the Soviet Union, but it was the end of history and the triumph of liberal democracy. Is your book to some degree an answer to that?
It's a strong attack on that Fukuyama, Francis Fukuyama, 1989 idea, which, as you know and listeners know, just captured the moment of those velvet revolutions in the summer and autumn of 1989 by saying that this represented proof of the triumph of the idea of liberal democracy that is traceable back to the American founding fathers. This book, The Life and Death of Democracy, argues in two ways against that view. It says that actually this is not a continuation. We go back to the very beginning of our conversation. This is not a continuation of pre-1989 democracy at all. There is some kind of rupture, some kind of transformation that's going on. Monetary democracy, that's different. And secondly, Fukuyama has no understanding, and today still has no understanding, of what could be called the indigenization of democracy. I mean, if you go to India, you see that the key question is not only what democracy has done to India, but what India has done to democracy. It has given it colour, life, but it's also changed the meaning of democracy. It is an experiment, sticking with the Indian case, completely absent in Fukuyama's idea of the end of history. India is a case where it shows that you can democratize in a context where the vast majority of the population has no reading or writing skills, where there are multiple faiths, multiple identities, multiple languages. The Indian experiment shows that actually you need democracy in order to make this collage of peoples and identities actually crystallize and coherent. So this transformation of democracy in so many global contexts is going on. One of the basic ideas of the book is that the center of gravity of democracy is now in the Asia and Pacific region. This is where its future will be decided.
So finally then, and this is obviously in our region an extraordinarily important question, which is more likely to succeed, the Indian model which you've been praising, or the Chinese model where they try to have economic freedom but no political freedom, no democracy?
Well, if I was Professor Marvel, the character in the possibly most famous American movie ever, The Wizard of Oz, I would be able to look in my crystal ball and tell you the outcome. In the book...
You can look backwards, though, and probably extrapolate.
Yes, in the book, I... Well, one can, and one of the key reasons for putting eyes in the backs of our heads when it comes to democracy is that it can teach us about the novelties of our times and of the things that should not be done. And it's clear, looking at the region, that we have a mixture of systems. There is the most successful breakthrough, the Indian case. I see it as not only the world's largest democracy, that's the convenient cliche, but it is a cutting-edge example of where democracy is going in the 21st century. And we have, on the other hand, we have the Chinese case. The present regime is one which talks the language of democracy. It even issued a white paper quite recently on the subject. But it practices a system of authoritarianism, which has in some areas strong police control. You can see this on internet, concerning the internet policy of control. Growing inequality and growing military power. And I think the Australian difficulty is somehow to fashion a new foreign policy that can reconcile these irreconcilables. I have no doubt that it must involve a regional settlement. I do not think, contrary probably to the present government, that China is the key player in this relationship. It will have to include India, because India too is a rising power. And in a way, the analogy is with the European Union. The problem is somehow to fashion, to create, to craft new institutions that can develop a process further in which non-violent reconciliation of differences among these states not only makes democracy possible and secures democracy in India, in Australia, in Japan, probably in Indonesia, in Taiwan, but can also assist, if it's going to happen, the democratization process in China. And if you want to see the alternative in China, it is Charter 08. If you read the text, most Chinese people have been denied the text, I discovered upon a recent visit in Shanghai. But if you read the text, it is a model of a vision of monitory democracy for China. It says free and fair elections, but we want more. We want guarantees of free trade unions and free journalism, human rights organizations, and we want to have links across borders as well. I mean, that kind of vision of China has old roots. Those who say that we shouldn't interfere with Chinese developments, that the Chinese by nature are not interested in democracy, misread history. The language of democracy and the interest and experimentation with checks and balances, with monitoring, controlling power, go back well into the 19th century. So this is one of the great political questions, not only for Australia, but I think the future of democracy will be co-determined by what happens in China.